volcanoes, like some geologists are. It's one of these kind of a one in a lifetime sorts of things, hopefully. Especially to those of us who live around in rather close proximity to it. Messy early on, but interesting thereafter, I guess, would be a way to put it. But I think in order to kind of give you a sense of what went on and then deal with a bit of the after effects, as you might imagine, in 1980, the local TV station had a marvelous time, and one of the really fine things that came out of all this was a production by one of the Seattle television stations. And what made it rather fascinating, I guess, was the fact that they did it without narration, and they started from the very beginnings of the eruption. The volcano began to erupt on, well, it gave first signs in late March of 1980, and then as it gradually progressed by about the 1st of April, it was spotting a little bit of steam and ash, and then it erupted off and on pretty much all the way through April. And then on May 18th, why it really cut loose. And so you'll see a little bit of the early days of the eruption, and then on to what happened the day of the eruption in some detail. It's only about, I don't know, 6 or 8 minutes long, but as I say, it's done without narration, so it's really kind of a neat production. We'll see if we can get all this high-tech equipment going here.
Did they anticipate this to be as big as it was?
Pardon me?
Did they anticipate this eruption to be as big as it actually happened?
Well, anticipation of natural events is a mighty shaky kind of process, any more than somebody can tell you where you live how big the tornado might be, or whether it's going to hit your house or your neighborhood. Give warnings about there we go.
The eruption of Mount St. Helens provided those of us at Cairo TV News with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to cover an incomparable news story. And no one rose to the challenge more than our staff of photojournalists, whose job it was to capture the majesty and the fury of Mount St. Helens and the devastation that it caused. When the ashes settled, we had accumulated a library of incredible pictures. Then Cairo photographer Steve Baxter set out to mix these pictures with music and create an unforgettable video. So sit back now, relax, and enjoy the very fine work of Cairo's photojournalists.
About what you saw there.
You know, that the governor told them to close off the road up to Mount St. Helens after that march and after Black on Top, way before the May eruption, because they didn't want people to go up there just in case something happened. The people would go around and they would sneak up there anyway.
Yeah, the question about trying to predict things like this, as I said early on, trying scientifically to say what's going to happen in natural events is a real crapshoot, because Mother Nature doesn't always cooperate with what we might think, and especially things like this. With Mount St. Helens, there was really, in this country, no line of evidence to fall back on. The geologists or volcanologists looked at some of the eruptions that had happened before, and the only previous eruption of any note in this country was Mount Lassen in back about 1915, and it was remote and not very well studied. So here came Mount St. Helens, and when it began to become active, why, of course, as you saw in the video, there was a lot of development around Spirit Lake, especially at the base of, right at the base of the mountain. A lot of people had cabins. Harry Truman had his lodge. Harry Truman became famous and is now buried there by the eruption, not by choice. The government agencies then were forced to try and make some kind of decision over what is considered a danger zone and whether or not to allow people to go into the area. They blocked the highways, the main highways, or at least put guards on them, but in Forest Service land like this is, or timber company land, there are about 100 places or ways to get in that they just simply can't guard every single entry. And a lot of very unhappy people, because they had their cabins in there and they wanted to get things out of the cabin, or they wanted to go vacation there, or whatever it may be. Finally they let people in on the Saturday before, on May 17th, as a matter of fact, and they were supposed to let another group in at 10 o'clock on May 18th, which was a fortuitous thing, because the mountain erupted about 8 o'clock. So those folks were left out. But they tried to set up a danger zone around the mountain, and they had a red zone and a blue zone. The red zone was a stay out completely zone. The blue zone was supposed to be only with permission kind of thing. And as it turned out, there were, I think, 57 people confirmed dead by virtue of the eruption. And as I recall, only three of those people were in what was considered to be the red zone. The rest were all in the blue zone, because it was a very, very unusual kind of eruption. Well, let's have a little further look at the world's volcanoes occur in some fairly predictable patterns. As you can see here by the red dots, the majority of the world's volcanoes are in rather nice linear patterns. And Susan referred to some of this as the Ring of Fire, and that's really not named after me. Most of the volcanoes in the world that are active occur in this area right around the Pacific Ocean. And this is also the major earthquake zone, but nevertheless, we're looking at volcanoes right now. Rather complex group down here in the South Atlantic, here in the Caribbean through the string of Lesser Antilles Islands, off through Indonesia, and some through the Red Sea, and of course through the Mediterranean, where we have Etna and Vesuvius and some of those that are active. And a few scattered here and there, Hawaii and some of those that are kind of oddities that don't follow the predictable pattern. So most of the volcanoes are in these kind of areas. When you see volcanic eruptions, you're not likely to see something like you just saw. You might see about 10 seconds of that, if that long, because folks don't want to watch old dirty ash boiling up in the air. I mean, hold on. Mm-hmm. They want to see lava rolling around and that hot stuff getting from here to there and whatever. And those are the Hawaiian kind of eruption, probably 99 times out of 100. If you see a volcanic eruption in the movies or something, if it isn't faked, if it's real footage, then it's come from Hawaii, because there the lavas are different. They come out as a very fluid, very hot lava. They just pour out on the ground and away they go. With most of the volcanoes, like we see here in the Ring of Fire, there are two separate things. One, the kind of lava is different, and secondly, it has a lot of volatile material in it, the volatile material being primarily steam. So most of what you see coming out in a volcanic eruption like Mount St. Helens is really steam with a lot of ash perhaps picked up and blown along with it that makes it look kind of dirty and ugly. But when it's mostly white, like most of what you're seeing is just steam. So my usual analogy is to say a volcanic eruption like Mount St. Helens is sort of like taking a warm soda pop or soda container of some kind on a nice day, shaking it up good, and then popping the top. And when the pressure is relieved, whatever causes that, the result is that the gases that are in that are going to drive it out, and away it goes. And that's pretty typical of an eruption like Mount St. Helens. Here in our part of the country, we have a fracture zone off the coast that's known as the Juan de Fuca Ridge. The Juan de Fuca Ridge is a place where the ocean floor is being torn apart. And the part of it that's on this side, on the east side, is gradually moving toward the east. We have the North American segment over here, the plate that we're on is moving westward, and they're running into each other. And when that happens, the oceanic plate here will go down and under the edge of the other one, and ultimately it results in a lot of increase in temperature, wet materials, melting of the rocks, and they come up in the form of volcanoes. So all the way down the west coast, from Mount Garibaldi up here in British Columbia down to Lassen Peak or Mount Lassen in California, is a nice long chain of volcanoes that make up the Cascades. And that's where it ends. They're all associated with this one segment of the Juan de Fuca Ridge. The next volcanoes actually don't pick up again until one gets down into Mexico. These are composite volcanoes. They're named because they form by periodic eruptions of some lava, but when the lava comes out, it's very thick and very gooey, not at all like what you see in Hawaii. It doesn't run very far, it goes a little bit down the side of the mountain. And then there'll be periodic eruptions like the one you just saw, where there's a lot of ash and steam and so forth. And the result is it makes a big layer cake volcano. And these are composite volcanoes. This is all the major volcanoes in the Cascade. In fact, most major volcanoes around the world, with the exception of the Hawaiian ones, are composite volcanoes. Mount Fuji or Mayon or Popocatepetl or Aconcagua or whoever you might be. Those are classic composite volcanoes. In the Cascades, we have the whole string of them. This is Mount Hood down by Portland. This is Mount Adams. This is Mount St. Helens before she lost her head. When the eruption first took place, or began in early April, and this was taken, about the 10th or 12th of April, something like that. It was a pretty ominous sight because Mount St. Helens, up until that time, had been kind of the darling of the Cascades. It was a beautiful, symmetrical cone, nice, pristine white, really pretty nice, smooth sides. It wasn't chewed up like a lot of the big volcanoes are, so it really had a somewhat different appearance, and you can see the nice conical shape here, but once it started to get coated with ash, why, it took on kind of an ominous appearance, certainly, and looked that way that day. And then it began to undergo some fairly spectacular steam and ash and gas eruptions out of the top vent. But the one thing that was perhaps most striking was that a fairly large bulge started to grow up here on the north side of the volcano. And the volcanologists figured that this was probably the movement of magma, molten rock, inside the volcano, and that was causing this bulge to be pushed out. So it gradually grew a little bit larger and a little bit larger. And then on May 18th, a fairly modest-sized earthquake occurred. That was enough to shake that bulge loose, and that brought about the series of pictures that you saw in the video that were taken by a photographer just up on the north side of the mountain. And it actually started with this huge debris avalanche coming down. And then the first thing that happened is that here's the top popped on the soda pop, and the stuff begins to spout right straight up. But because of the way the huge avalanche occurred, it opened up the whole side of the mountain, and the result was that the remaining part of the blast, and almost the entire blast, went out laterally, went out horizontally, right out the front of the mountain. And along with this came this big, huge cloud of very hot gases and ash and steam, very dense, rolling down the mountain. In a retrospect, it was a marvelous thing that the photographer who took the picture didn't get wiped out, because it so happened that it kind of bypassed the area where they were standing. But it was a huge avalanche. So here was Mount St. Helens in the before, beautiful conical peak, the same view taken about 3 months later. Actually lost about 1,300 feet of the top of the mountain to this big, massive debris avalanche and partway to the explosion. So it was a humdinger. You saw pictures, of course.
Is that a geological term?
Humdinger, yeah. Yeah, we use that all the time. Especially for emphasis. Spirit Lake was a spectacular spot, and like I say, all the way around the lake, especially on here kind of on the mountain side, there were all kinds of facilities, lodges and cabins and various youth camps and all sorts of things. And again, a little bit of a change in appearance in a very short period of time, rather dramatic. It was hard to believe, frankly, that much of the mountain actually disappeared. This was taken out of the National Geographic. I always liked it because it was, again, a very good illustration of before and after. Spirit Lake, actually, when the eruption occurred, when the avalanche occurred, all this material came off the front of the mountain, went right down into the lake, actually splashed the lake completely out of its basin, and went up the hills or the mountains on this side, and all this stuff just slid into the lake basin. And then what was left of the water came back down and filled up what was left of its old lake bed. And now the floor of the lake was about 300 feet higher than it had been before the eruption. And along with this came thousands and thousands of board feet of wood. And all this brown you see here, especially on this side of the lake, there was a little open water over here, but all this is floating wood. That's covering the surface of the lake. When the eruption occurred, prevailing winds pushed almost all the ash off into eastern Washington, Some of the later eruptions, a little bit went down into Portland, a little bit went to the north, but most of it went off to the east because that's the way the wind blows. But what was really strange was that there was a fair bit that was dumped right by the mountain, but the rest of it blew up in the air, the wind picked it up, blew it across Washington and dumped it over here in pretty much in eastern Washington in the vicinity of Spokane. So these areas got, an inch or two of ash. The areas over here around Richville, the community of Richville, a little bit west of Richville, got as much as 4 or 5 inches of ash. So it was a really strange fly over the top kind of pattern. Where I live in Ellensburg, we were kind of on the north fringe of it, but it started out as what looked to be a nice big thundercloud coming until we heard the reports that it was not a thundercloud. And of course, by this time there was starting to be a little ash falling out of it, but you can see the cloud beginning to roll in. South of us in Yakima, I went to Ellensburg too, it was really not very photographable in Ellensburg, but this was taken in Yakima. All the street lights came on, the chicken went to roost, it was just absolutely pitch black about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and for about 3 hours until the main ashfall was over with. This was taken by a friend in Moses Lake. They had been headed toward Ellensburg when the ashfall hit them, so they pulled into some friends, got up the next morning, and this is what they found on the patio, was about 2.5 inches of ash covering everything. You can see the way the terrain looks in the background. That white is not sand, that's all ash. We had, about three fairly sizable eruptions after the May 18th one, one in July, one in August, the one that went down really didn't bother Ellensburg, but again, you can see the edge of the big ash cloud here. There's another one that came rolling along, but nothing at all like the May 18th eruption. This was taken just south of Ellensburg, between Ellensburg and Yakima, I guess maybe a month after the eruption. And all this light color stuff, again, is ash. But interestingly enough, I could take you out there right now and I'd defy you to find any. Disastrous as it looked during the event and shortly afterwards, after a matter of a few years, why virtually all of it was gone, it either blown on a little further or gradually covered over with vegetation and organic material. So the remnants are pretty hard to find now. But a little bit about the eruption itself. Again, here's what's left of the mountain. This is all the blast zone out in the front. This is Spirit Lake. The Spirit Lake was kind of a V-shaped lake, and this is all wood covering one side of the lake and over here, and then there was a little bit of open water left over here on this side. Now a lot of it has gradually gotten water soaked and sunk to the bottom of the lake, and the lake is really rebounding rather well now. There are fish in it and aquatic life of different kinds, so it's amazingly kind of coming back. But the primary part of the blast, when the volcanologist from the Geologic Survey tried to set up a safe zone or danger zone, if you will, really all they could do was establish kind of a bullseye pattern around the mountain and say, okay, if there's eruption of a certain size, that's the danger zone, and this is what they did. The red zone was kind of a box or a bullseye around the mountain. The blue zone went a little bit further than that. But when the eruption occurred, the blast zone then went way off to the north and much further than anybody anticipated then. So Perhaps the only really fortuitous thing was that it occurred on a Sunday. And for that reason, it did kill some people who had gone in sightseeing and what have you. Perhaps it wouldn't have been there if it had been on Monday or Friday or something. But it did spare an awful lot of people that worked in the lumber industry, because this is a big lumbering area, and a lot of wood crews would have been out there and would certainly have been done in. So something to work. The huge mud flows that you saw went down the Tula River this way, swept up all kinds of ash and debris, and ultimately clear on down into the Columbia River, taking houses along in some cases, and all kinds of wood that happened to be nearby, and vehicles, washed out roads, washed out bridges. Here's a view along the lower part of the Tula, and you can see, this is after the mud flow had gone by, but you can see the level by looking at the white spots up here on the side of the tree, where it was when it passed by. So it was pretty devastating. The most sobering thing, I think, was to go up to the mountain and walk along, and you would come to an area where there was just absolutely nothing at all in terms of trees, and look down and see the stump of a 2-foot diameter tree that was just nothing but a few shreds and tatters standing there, and realize that the force of the blast had just simply taken a 2-foot tree and snapped it off of the ground and taken it who knows where. Away from the mountain a little bit further, the trees were just simply bowled over and laid down like jackstraws, because this big, huge cloud of pumice and gas and ashes just rolled along like a steamroller, and in the process just simply laid the wood down whichever way that cloud happened to be going, which was pretty much controlled by the topography, by the rolling and swale of the hills.
Don, was there a wind that went with this?
Well, yeah, in the sense that this was moving along probably at a couple hundred miles an hour, yeah. So there's certainly a certain amount of wind, if you will, a lot of force.
Yeah.
The area around the mountain had been very heavily clear-cut, so it's not always easy to tell what's missing and what's been clear-cut. This is all pretty much missing, but again, you can see the jackstraw patterns where the trees have just simply been laid down. Pretty amazing. It was two or three of the lumber companies that had a lot of holdings in this area. I came in, and once the real initial danger seemed to be over, and tried to do some salvage work, but it was pretty much for naught. The trees were all embedded with ash, and it was extremely difficult on equipment, and of course the terrain itself was all ash covered, so it was a pretty limited operation. But perhaps the most startling thing, as we looked at some of the areas, the big ash cloud had rolled down here, and you can see the way it's laid the trees down, bowled them over. It was hot enough along the margins to actually take the branches and the foliage off these trees, and I call it a singe fringe. This is about a 200 to 300 foot wide zone in here. And then right into green forest. A little tiny bit of singeing here and there, but this was a cloud that was rolling along at extremely high temperatures, high velocities, just absolutely bowling everything down, and then at the very fringes burning things up, or at least singeing them. But the cloud goes by so quickly, in order to start a fire, you have to apply heat long enough to start to vaporize the material, especially with something like wood. If the torch goes by so quickly that it doesn't stay there long enough to vaporize the wood and actually ignite it, all it does is give a little quick singe and away it's gone. It's gone. That's what happened here. There were no fires associated with the eruption. Well, I shouldn't say that quite so strongly. There were a few places where trees had been bowled over and were buried in some of the hot ash and stuck up enough and sat there in that hot material long enough to finally ignite. And so there were, you know, a few little spot fires, but here were millions of board feet of wood bowled over, laid down, give a little quick singe, and the cloud was gone.
What was the composition of the ash?
Well, it's just a high silica material, mostly, I don't know, quartz. It has a somewhat different composition than a window, but not a whole lot. So it's just a siliceous material. There was concern, of course, that it might be somewhat poisonous, which it wasn't, and it would be infertile, which it isn't. It's not as fertile as some other kind of ash sometimes, but no trauma from that. It's not very good to sit out and breathe it. It certainly wasn't very good for automobiles because it plugged up the air filters almost instantly, and there were cars stranded everywhere, and because trying to drive through the air would get plugged up within a very short time, and the car just simply would quit. But anyway, this happens, and gruesome as it sounds, this happens also to any other thing that happens to be in the path. The people that were actually killed by the very hot gas cloud were just basically fried in their clothes. They got just a quick blast of extremely high temperatures. In many cases, the clothes were not even set on fire. The cloud just rolled on by and just left it behind. The last part of the eruption, and the only lava that was associated with the eruption, came out not too long after the initial eruption, initial explosive part of it was over, and it began to grow a dome by pushing some molten rock up into the dome. And actually, the first one that was built, you saw in one of the pictures of the ash clouds, because the very earliest one was blown away about 2 months later. After that, there were no large eruptions, and the dome has pretty much continued to grow. For the most part, it's grown by the lava pushing up from a vent on the inside and actually causing the dome to just simply swell. And with a few exceptions, here's a little bit of a flow that came down the outside where the stuff came up to the top of the dome and ran down the edge. But most of it just was pushing up inside and then just kind of swelling the dome a little bit larger. So I don't know, the last tally I can remember is that the dome is about 700 or 800 feet high probably 1,200 feet wide, something like that. But it hasn't shown any sign of activity now to speak of for probably 3 or 4 or 5 years, but who knows? Most of the Cascade volcanoes show a pattern something like this that's gone on somewhere in the past. Mount Rainier does, Mount Baker does, Mount Hood does. So they've had explosive eruptions in the past and then oftentimes have kind of regrown or rebuilt. So at this point, nobody really knows what's going to happen with Mount St. Helens. But anyway, right now it's in a relatively quiet state.
Okay. Anything near Holden?
Is it anywhere near Holden?
Yeah.
No, our nearest volcano is just about due west of us, and that's Glacier Peak. And then as you go south in the Cascades, Mount Rainier is next, down by, well, just a ways south of Seattle, and Mount St. Helens is actually down Oh, it's a lot closer to Portland probably than any of the other cities around, just way north of the Oregon border, so it's not...
Did the ash reach this far?
Well, Susan said it did. I've never seen any of it, but, and maybe it did on the second trip around, I don't know. Preventing winds picked it up, and it did actually make a complete circuit of the globe when it got into the jet stream, so it might have gone all the way around to get back here. I don't think anything came from the record from the eruption to here.
He said they wore masks.
Well, yeah, a lot of people wore little paper fiber masks to keep from breathing the ash. And of course, if you were downtown Yakima, when the picture was taken there, that would have been a good idea. You don't want to breathe a whole lot of that stuff. In fact, some of the casualties were caused by that very thing. People were caught in the ash fall and just simply suffocated from breathing the ash. So they weren't all incinerated, but
Glacier Peak right up here.
Uh-huh.
That's a volcano.
Yeah, that's a volcano. But it hadn't erupted of any note for about 12,000 years, so you'll be able to get out probably before we before we have any trouble from it.
We climbed the one in Maui, Hawaii, and they feel that will erupt again within about 145 years. I don't know how they predict that, but that's what they said.
Oh yeah. Well.
Most of the Hawaiian volcanoes, the ones like Maui and Kauai and Oahu, and those are all kind of headed west, and their cycles are over. I'm a little surprised. I guess somebody would look at it as being still dangerous because all the activity now is on Hawaii. But maybe so. I'm not that much into the Hawaiian volcanism. John?
Is Toodle River, is it running clear again?
Or? Yeah, it's running clear, and there are fish zooming up and spawning and things like that now, so it's pretty clear. It's ugly. It's taken a while. Of course, since these were taken, a lot of the area has go ahead and push that button all the way to the back if you want.
Just back here?
Yeah. No, just the one on top. Just push it all the way to the back. There you go. These were taken within, most of them within a year or two after the eruption. And last time I was up in the Toodle River, it's still awfully ugly in terms of the terrain, but the water itself is pretty nice. There's been a lot of vegetation grow back, and they did a fair bit of planting in some places early on. But much of the area now, of course, is in a national monument, so it's going to be let develop naturally without any artificial help. And
have the animals returned?
Pardon?
Have the animals returned?
Oh yeah, yeah. You can drive up there now. At least the last time I was there, there were elk all over the place, and it didn't take them long to get back in. As soon as a little bit of vegetation appeared, they moved right back in again.
I live in the Puget Sound Basin, and the second eruption, well, I saw that on Sunday, but all we got over there was like a light dusting on the bushes and stuff.
I remember one of the eruptions occurred in conjunction with Portland's Rose Parade, and that caused a big trauma. They weren't happy to have Mount St. Helens send ash over for the parade. But yeah, something like in the Seattle area, most of the time the preventing wind was the other way, and they happened to get one little bit that blew up there, and it'd be like maybe your car after a dust storm or something. Got a little bit of ashy stuff on the windshield.
My wife and I were over in Yakima, and I went out into her relative's backyard, and I scooped up a pint of Mount St. Helens ash as a souvenir.
Uh-huh.
And we also stopped by this place where they were blowing glass, and they were using Mount St. Helens ash to make Christmas balls.
I think probably in the area around the mountain, you can probably still get a lot of stuff that they say is Mount St. Helens ash, and I've been over and it's hard to say it isn't, but yeah, a lot of it became souvenir stuff, not nearly enough. I hauled, I don't know how many bags of the stuff out of my yard and off my roof and all that sort of thing, and took it up the mountains and dumped it. So someday some geologist is going to find a big deposit of ash up there and wonder how in the world we got it.
I live in Yakima, and in 1995, our condominium community had to re-roof, and so the shakes were taken off, and it was just like ash again.
Yeah.
While they were working on it, because it was all stuck in with the shakes.
Yeah. Well, I still think a little bit washes off my roof periodically. Well, no, not anymore either, because I haven't been re-roofed since then. But I was digging in some shrubbery and stuff not too very long ago, and nestled way down inside amongst the leaves and things was a fair little deposit of ash. So there's still a little bit here and there. If it's in some kind of secret spot, why, it'll survive.
We lived in Wolf Point, Montana, and about 2 days after that thing hit, that's about 1,200 miles, we got a nice dusting of ash.
Yeah. Yeah, I went across the northern tier rather convincingly for a fair ways, a little dust of it here and there.
People around Mount St. Helens said, when the vacation is, don't come to us, we'll come to you.
I'm interested in that ring of fire, the chain. There's such a pattern to it. Can you share with us any theory on
what's going on is that basically the whole Pacific Ocean is surrounded by what we call a subduction zone, just like we see here on our coastline, where the edge of the ocean is going down underneath the edge of the continents.
Oh, I see.
And when that happens, the result is about 100 to 150 miles away are going to be volcanoes.
Oh, I see.
So all the way down through Japan, the Philippines, that whole string is a very major subduction zone.
Mount Pinatubo is
in the Philippines.
Quite a bit larger than Mount St. Helens.
Well, you know,
or somewhat the same.
Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. This is one of the other fun things about dealing with volcanoes and predictions and so forth. Right now there were about 500 volcanoes in the world that were considered to be, we'll say, active. In other words, they had a history of eruption. They were looked at as being ones that could erupt again in some future date. Mount Pinatubo was nowhere on that list. In fact, I'm not even sure it was looked at all that much as even being a volcano. I guess it was looked at as an old volcano, but it was a long way from being on that list, and it had no sign of activity for I don't know how long, so long that it was certainly not recognized as being active until it came in. Now this was also a Class A case of the volcanologists coming in and monitoring the eruption. They had Mount St. Helens to look at for quite a while and recognized some indicators. And they looked at Mount Pinatubo and they said, up to a certain point, they said, folks, you better get out. And so they cleared Clark Air Force Base, Subic Bay Naval Station. They got all the American bases cleared away, gave the warning to the Philippine government that they better get their people out of there. And so a lot of it did take place, and so a lot of what happened avoided a heck of a lot of loss of life. But, you know, again, people want to know immediately when some natural event is imminent, how big is it going to be, or is it going to bother me, or don't let it don't tell me what to do. I have property here. I don't want to be bothered. They want instant answers, and it was very frustrating for the volcanologists who were trying to deal with Mount St. Helens and the government agencies that were trying to deal with it. And and obviously it doesn't always work, because I can name you probably a dozen times when somebody cried wolf for a natural disaster and nothing happened, and then all you do is stand around with egg on your face and everybody's mad at you. If you don't say anything, well, everybody's mad because you didn't tell them. And so it's a no-win situation unless it all works out. Unless you say, okay, it's going to erupt, and everybody get out, and everybody gets out and it erupts, then everybody's happy, I guess. But it doesn't work that way.
Well, we knew it was going to blow, but we thought it was going to blow on either Portland or Seattle. We had no idea the wind would blow it over Yakima.
Well, you got a bad rap there, because the winds are almost invariably from the west, and they were a little more northwest then than perhaps normal. But we're going to get the ash if those things go off.
It was mentioned that an earthquake triggered off the explosion. Did the mountain create its own earthquake?
Well, there were earthquakes that actually foretold the eruption, because the initial sign that it was going to become active was in the form of a lot of small earthquakes right under the mountain. And
does the mountain generate this, or was it?
Well, what probably generates it is the initial movement of the molten rock underneath underneath the surface.
Yeah.
And as that stuff moves along, it tends to generate earthquakes. And this one was quite a bit bigger than most of the others. Were so small initially that people living around there probably didn't even notice them. But this one was about a, I don't know, 5'2" or something, so it was a fairly decent size for me.
When you talk about this ocean sliding under, like 1/8 of an inch every 100 years, or how do you?
Well, it varies a little bit, but we're talking about like your fingernails grow. The general movement is about anywhere 2, 3, 4 centimeters a year, perhaps. Some move a little faster than that, but so we're talking about an inch or inch and a half, maybe 2 inches. Not going to set any speed records. One of those. And then, interestingly enough, now with the satellite positioning and things, why all of the movements like that are really a lot more detectable, because they can make much more precise measurements than the old standard survey method. So.
How did the fish get back into Spirit Lake?
Some apparently survived for whatever reason. That's about all anybody can think of, that somehow a few of them did actually manage to survive all that trauma. At least they showed up. I suppose it's possible that some could have come in from some of the side streams or even come up the tube, I guess, but it was a real surprise to the biologists that fish showed up there.
What was her question?
Well, she had asked how fish got back into Spirit Lake, and I said I don't know. It was a real surprise to the biologists too, because they figured there wouldn't be any aquatic life at all in there, and when they started to see a fish or two, why, it was a real.
How about the elk? You said the elk were back. Now, did the elk that were there, did they suffocate?
Well, the ones that were there were wiped out, at least on that side of the mountain. Of course, much of the south side, well, probably over half the mountainous area, really wasn't affected by the blast, so they could have migrated in fairly easily from other parts of the mountain on the south.
They just suffocated from the ash? Is that
or were blown away in the blast or whatever. So I don't know. I've seen tallies of how many deer and elk and what have you that they think were probably killed. Squirrels and things like that that lived underground, a lot of those survived rather readily. They were in their, they got in their holes when they weren't bothered. Well, thank you for your patience.